CliffCentral.com.
All right, Wednesday morning, we've got loads of really good stuff and brand new interviews every single week on the Gareth Cliff Show with all kinds of guests. And sometimes a guest pops up who I don't expect. Sometimes it's somebody who, you know, you meet at a dinner or you start talking to them at some event that you're at. And Martha Ngoyi is one of those people. She was at a dinner that Pumi was at the other day. She's actually friends with Pumi. And Pumi said to me, you've got to talk to this woman because she's got the most incredible story about what happens in places like Prasa and Eskom, obviously, because that's also parastatal. And a lot of us wonder how it really works and why we don't pick up on these enormous amounts of money that are fraudulently taken out of the companies by these crooks. And Martha Ngoyi was there at Prasa at the time that Lucky Montana, infamous Lucky Montana, was the CEO. In fact, she stood in for him as acting CEO for a while, and that was when she uncovered all the skullduggery. Now, in this story, we go through a part of her history in corporate South Africa before that and what she did afterwards, where she worked, how she uncovered all of this stuff, and the unbelievable battle she's been waging ever since. She's still in the middle of a whole lot of action against Prasa, and she will continue to take them on until she feels that she has been vindicated. They accused her. They tried to blame her for all the things that were going wrong. And she stood her ground, to her credit. So I'm really, really pleased I got to speak to her. And I also got to speak to her lawyer, who is Jeffrey Alsop. He was there as well. And the two of them both really laid it all out, because there's so many of these stories that we hear about and we kind of think we know the whole story. But until you've spoken to the people involved, you don't really know what's going on. So take a listen to this. I think it'll blow your mind. Martha Ngoye is an attorney of the High Court of South Africa and has practiced as a corporate lawyer and worked for some of South Africa's most prestigious firms. She also answered the call of the corporate giants and went to work for Standard Bank and Barclays, among others. This was in a tumultuous period when the big white law firms weren't ready for women, and especially black women. Martha then headed the Patriotic Call, which is something a lot of people are nervous to do these days. And she decided she'd go and build and strengthen the civil service. So she joined Transnet, which is South Africa's government-owned freight rail and shipping infrastructure company. She later joined PRASA, the Passenger Rail Agency of South Africa, where she continues to fight a ceaseless wave of corruption. This brave stance has led to much suffering and victimization, which she is still fighting to this day. In fact, she's with us here today at our studio with her lawyer. It's very nice to see you here too. Jeffrey, thank you for coming in.
Thank you.
And Martha, thank you, because I don't mean just thank you for coming in here. Thank you for being brave enough to do what so many people wish they could do. And the ones who do often find themselves victimized, treated very badly, bullied, very often worse than that. Whistleblowers, they talk a big game in South Africa. They say, oh, whistleblowers are the people we need in society to expose corruption. But we don't do very much in this country to protect whistleblowers.
That's right.
In fact, the people who they often blow the whistle on will go to ever more nefarious ends to get rid of those people. Yep. So thank you for coming, and thank you for being brave enough to speak out.
Thank you. Yeah.
So Martha, let's just start with you and your story. I mean, I touched on your history in corporate South Africa, your history in the civil service, but what's your background? Where were you born? What's your story?
I was born in Diepkloof, Soweto, in fact, Baragwanath Hospital.
Sure.
At the time when it was still called that, 1969, December. And I've lived in Soweto basically till I went to varsity. So I grew up there in Diepkloof. And our area is called Ghost Town because, yes, there was belief that there was a ghost doing the rounds at night. But anyway, That's what it's called. I went to school, in Diepkloof and matriculated in 87. And then went to varsity. You know, my parents couldn't afford. So I went to UNISA. The first year, 88. And then 89, I managed to get a bursary with my dad's work, Siemens. And I was able to do my BProc at the University of the Western Cape. 4-year stint done. I came back. I couldn't take the Cape Town. environment. I came back to Wits, did my LLB 2 years. I was funded by TEFSA at the time.
Right.
So after that, fortunately, I got articles with Edward Nathan and Friedland at the time. It was
Remember
called.
Them?
Yeah. So I did my articles with them, and then I, you know, became an associate there. And then I decided, let me try corporate. So that's when I went to Standard Bank. I did 5 years stint at Standard Bank, and when Barclays came back, you know.
So what years were with Standard Bank?
This Standard Barclays. Bank was, 98.
Wow. So, I mean, South Africa, when I mentioned that, you know, the corporate hierarchy there was still very much what it had been for like 60, 70 years beforehand.
Yeah.
So coming in, it must have been a bit of a culture shock for them and for you.
Yeah. Look, it was. And I suppose, you know, you come in, it's this big bank open floor plan, and you just sit there and you basically do your work. But I suppose what I liked at Standard Bank is that they recognized potential, you know, and I was given the opportunities to really grow. And when I finished 5 years at Standard Bank, it was around 2003 when Barclays came in. I joined Barclays because I wanted to go more into the treasury space.
Mm.
And they offered me that potential. So I was at Barclays for about
3 years. Was that because you already had an eye to going into something in the public service?
No, not even at that time.
Okay.
You know, I thought this is my niche.
Great
this
job.
Is where I'm going to be staying and so on. So when Barclays did the APSA stint, in fact, I was part and parcel of the people that did that particular transaction. Culture-wise, I just thought I don't fit at APSA. And then, you know, I thought about it and I thought, okay, maybe I should go and do the, you know, civil duty type thing. And I just get position came up at Transnet 2006. I was given that position.
That was when Maria Ramos was there.
That's right.
Okay. So a very different environment.
Yeah.
And Transnet, I mean, under her aegis, she seems to have run a pretty tight ship.
She was.
And she was obviously looking for talent.
That's it.
And did they approach you or did you approach them?
They didn't approach me. There was an opening.
Oh,
which
okay.
I picked up and then I applied and I got it.
Okay.
Yeah. And for, I think, a year or two, I ran the legal department alone.
Whew, for the whole of Transnet.
Group.
That must have been
for group,
24/7, 365.
It was crazy.
No holidays, no weekends.
Yeah, it was crazy.
Because I know how lawyers in firms work and you bill by the hour.
Yeah.
So you need to be available. Some people have you on retainers.
Yeah.
They think they can call you while you're having dinner with your family, while you're supposedly away. Right? I mean, that's what happens, right? I mean, you're gesturing to Jeffrey, but this is the life of a lawyer. And especially if you want to be competitive.
That's it, yeah.
And you want to be at the top of your game and you want to bill big hours and you want to be taken seriously, you have to put in the work.
Hours. Yeah, you put in the hours.
So there's no release from that. And you ran it all on your own at Transnet. Again, there must have been so many matters you had to deal with on a daily basis.
And that was the time when it was restructuring.
Oof.
Selling off its non-core assets. So, you know,
and if you put a foot wrong when you're in a government department, there's even more scrutiny than there would be in many private businesses because you're dealing with public money.
Yes.
And the reason we've got so much red tape these days is because there's so much corruption and people don't want to see as much of it, which means that you have to jump through 8 hoops instead of just 2.
Yeah. So you're right. I mean, it was hectic and the type of transactions that we were doing. I mean, you know, Transnet, the type of business it's running. We
7, 8, 9 figures.
Yeah. So it was crazy. And during Maria's period, we did a lot of transactions. So one was extremely busy. But also at Transnet, what I figured is that I needed to grow, you know, and operate at an executive level because that's where I was operating, you know, in any event, but not necessarily given the recognition of, you know, operating at that level. So when an opportunity came at PRASA, in fact, it was at Intersight in 2011, I thought, okay, this gives me an opportunity to operate at an executive level. That's where I want to be. And I took it. So,
and who was in charge of PRASA then?
Lucky Montana was in charge of PRASA.
Okay, so the reason I ask is because the only reason that any of us in South Africa know the names of Maria Ramos and of Lucky Montana is because these people have been in the news.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, sometimes for good reasons
yeah.
in the case of the latter, sometimes yeah. for bad reasons in the case of the former.
Yeah.
And it's normally not the kind of job that would garner a huge amount of public attention.
Exactly.
Most people in South Africa, if things are running fine, don't care who's in charge of PRASA. Yeah. And in the case of Transnet, which was running very well at the time, we only knew it was Maria Ramos because she had started developing a profile.
Yes.
And we'd known her from various government circles before.
That's right, yeah.
And she had been touted for other positions yes. as well. So she was prominent. In Lucky Montana's case, he was making news for the wrong reasons.
That's right, yeah. So when I arrived, I was a group executive in the office of the CEO at Intersight, which is a wholly owned subsidiary of PRASA.
Mm-hmm.
Within 8 months, the job of the CEO of Intersight came up. I applied and I got it. So around about September, then I was the CEO.
And what do they do inside of PRASA?
So we were an asset investment.
Okay.
Yeah, niche. There was just like 23 of us. So highly skilled. We were like the think
tank. What were
you
buying?
Think tank. So we were basically trying to invest in properties, leverage, you know, what PRASA has as far as properties are concerned. We had development leases that were out there that we were not benefiting from, you know, so we were.
And actual infrastructure.
Yeah.
Like stations yeah. and trains yeah. and railway. And
so what we were doing is putting, you know, plans together, ideas together to say PRASA can get that money, right? And not rely so heavily on the state. Because PRASA is subsidized. So effectively, we wanted to use our property portfolio, you know, to basically make
to leverage
money.
Yeah. And Martha, as I understand it, both at Transnet and at PRASA, South Africa had a pretty good yeah. rail infrastructure.
Of course we did.
For that's why now you see so many trucks on the road, because we've abused and allowed that to
happen,
run into rack and ruin.
Yeah.
Even though we're a big country, and a lot of other big countries, with the exception of Russia and China and places like that, which have to cover vast distances, America too, they have a good rail infrastructure, but nowhere near. At the level of concentration we had, there were stations in every little dorpie in South Africa for passengers.
Yes.
And for freight. The purposes of freight, I mean, our ports were connected to all the major centers. And for industry, this is essential in any country that wants to take part in a meaningful way.
Yeah.
In a developing economy.
Yeah.
And to be in charge of the legal aspects of all of that, and as the CEO of this Intersight company that you were, there's an enormous amount of work that goes on behind the scenes.
Yeah. A lot. As I said, we were the think tank. So you can imagine we had corporate financiers in there, you know, because we had to come up with these strategies. And what was difficult, in fact, you know, was that sometimes the language that we spoke was not understood internally, because, you know, you're speaking really highly corporatized language and stuff like that, you know, and equities and, you know,
governance.
That's it. So
compliance, all these words that, I mean, now these words are kind of derisoire, you know, everybody uses them, but at that point also, there was a lot of kind of naivety from the public and even I'd say from the government about what these things meant. Of course, you had to be familiar with it.
Of course. I mean, and also, you know, being a creature of statute, PRASA is a creature of statute, and therefore there's a statute that says this is how things must be done. And we know the PFMA is whatever it is, and it's quite tight. So we knew we had to comply with the PFMA. So when I got to PRASA, in fact, one of the things that I said to, I remember in one strategy session, because I was listening to what is happening, and as far as the PFMA compliance was concerned, it was like, no, it's very relaxed. And I said to Lucky in one of the
just
meetings,
for people who don't know, that's the private, the public
passenger,
PFMA is the Public Finance Management Act.
Right. So I said to Lucky, I said, you know, when I was at Transnet, the PFMA, we feared not complying with the PFMA, you know, fear of God. In fact, Chris Wells put the fear of God in us for non-compliance with the PFMA. And Lucky's response to me was that we don't fear God. Yeah.
So, boom. That must have put extra pressure on you.
I mean,
because you're like,
okay,
I'm dealing with a different animal here.
Yeah, you know. And so, you know, I had a 3-year stint at Intersight. And because of my legal background, you know, they needed assistance. The group Prasa now needed assistance as far as the legal portfolio was concerned. So there was a restructuring done. So for me, it was a lateral move across to Prasa to go and now work on the legal department, build it up, put in policies in place and so on. And so in 2014, I moved from Intersight, being the CEO, and we were the most profitable at the time I was there. We received compliance certificates. We received awards even from the AG, you know, for clean audits.
And the Auditor General has had an impeccable record in this respect. So we can take that very seriously.
Yeah. So when I went to Prasa in 2014 to head up this function, it was then broadened because the previous incumbent had group legal and compliance. So I then was given legal risk and compliance to look after, which was huge. But anyway, you come in and you've got to do what you have to do. And within 2 months, in fact, in November, December of that year, 2014, Lucky went on leave. He took a 2 months break. He then asked me to act as the group CEO. Yes.
And then you saw what was going on.
I did, yes. And I saw what was going on.
So Martha, and the reason we're going into some detail here is because I understand that, you know, there are ongoing processes. There's some stuff that you might not be able to share with us because it's still privileged and, you know, it could jeopardize your case. And that's why also we have Jeffrey here. But I think for a lot of people, we read headlines and we pay a little bit of respect and interest to these things. But we all complain about corruption. You know, we're full-throated about our problems with the system. Mm. But very few people are actually prepared to hear the story and to get into the reads.
Yes.
And when they do, sometimes they go, oh my God, it's way worse than I thought it was. Or they start feeling a little more humbled about how they were mouthing off about things without actually understanding.
Yeah.
Either way, there's ignorance here. Sure. So how was... until you took over as acting CEO, and even when you came in that lateral move, were these things like Prasa, were they being run like fiefdoms?
Yes.
Without any kind of respect being paid to statutory law, to the department that they fall under? Was there such a level of autonomy for someone like Lucky Montana that unless someone like you had come in, they probably would have carried on running things that way?
Yeah, no, there was. I mean, we knew, for instance, and this is evidence that's in the public domain because I also appeared at the state capture to give this type of evidence. I mean, there were certain politicians that we knew you couldn't, whose matters you couldn't touch. Roy Modley being one of those. And, you know, the toll trains. I mean, I was charged.
I remember
for
that. That was
trains.
Such an embarrassment.
Yeah.
And you were dragged into that.
Yeah, I was dragged into it. And when
let's be clear, you did not place that order.
No, I didn't. when the transaction came to us, in fact, initially how this particular transaction was done outside of the internal group legal space. So they appointed consultants who did this work. And then they wanted to increase the value of the transaction from 3 to 3.5 billion to 5 billion. And then this is when they brought it to the legal department. When we looked at this, we said, no, this is missing critical issues here.
What was that increase meant to be for?
Well, some more trains and that we didn't take care of the foreign exchange, the currency fluctuations in the previous 10.
Is that what they said or is that the truth?
That was effectively also the truth because it hadn't been taken care of. So, you know, issues of...
It was like a complete dereliction of duty on their part.
So,
and then we ended up with the trains that didn't
fit. Yeah, we got the trains. But also what was interesting is that the trains that we got were not the trains that we contracted for. So.
Yeah.
But anyway, I was charged.
Skullduggery on all sides.
So in the 2 months, it was quite hectic because there were a lot of matters that were happening. And
Lucky call and check in with you or?
I had to do it. And I think he did once because one of the charges, in fact, that was laid against me was the fence and gate charge, where, you know, there's monies that needed to be paid and so on, and lights, the lights contract, it came in. And I had to look at those things. And obviously, when I looked at the first one, I said, no, this doesn't give me a lot of comfort. Go back, give me more information. And he called me, you know, wanting to know why there was a delay with this particular memo. And I said, no, I still need more information. But in the background, you know, I knew that he wasn't happy with the delay because monies needed to be paid. And I was like, look, you
to
give
him?
Me. No, to this particular company.
Dealing.
Yeah. So anyway, we get the right memos, you know, I'm happy, and then I support this thing. It goes ahead. When Lucky comes back, but the other things that I picked up during, you know, his absence were things that he had promised the board of Popo Malefa at the time. And when they were now asking for delivery of those things, I went looking for those things that he had promised. For instance, in one of the tenders, which is about 4 billion rands, he said we had a property officer, and then there was no property officer, and the board was muffed.
So just before you move on to when he came back, because now suddenly you find yourself in this incredible storm,
yeah,
this deep water, you know that you're going to catch some flack for this personally.
Yeah.
So you start at this point, you as a someone who's experienced in the law,
yeah,
and has seen it from a private enterprise point of view and at Transnet, and you've seen how it can go right or wrong.
Yeah.
You start thinking, I better cover my backside here.
Well,
because
this is it.
Otherwise, you would be in jail right
yeah.
now.
I well, mean,
because they're always looking for a scapegoat,
not
right?
Sure.
And also, at this point, I just want to ask this question because for many people, it may be the most glaring one. You know, they always say, do not ascribe to malevolence what can be explained by incompetence.
Sure.
When you jumped into that job for 2 months, you sit at a desk and suddenly you have to access information that you haven't before. And you're given a wide purview because you have to make decisions. You're effectively making the CEO's decisions, mm-hmm. even though you're acting. There's no limit to what you have to do there.
Yeah.
For all intents and purposes, you've occupied the office. What kinds of things are going through your head? And what are the most immediate, because you triage this now. You're like, where do I begin? Because there's suddenly files piling up and they're getting more and more by the day.
Yeah.
How do you cope with that? And where do you start?
But this is the thing, you know, and I think for me, because I also had a very good team of lawyers, right? My direct report, who headed up the legal function, him and I worked very closely. So what I then did at the time, I said, listen, you better act in my state because I can't check myself when it comes to these things, because I've got to sign off.
Yeah.
You must check me. And that's how we worked it. And, you know, when the board realized that this, that they had been promised was not there, that was flack from Timbuktu. And I took it because I was acting, as you rightfully say. And when they started a different process to see if, you know, we had complied with what we needed to do as far as the particular tender was concerned, they found that we didn't.
And they're blaming you?
No, they didn't. Because when Lucky came back into office, I handed over to him to say, look, this is the work that I have done. This is what I uncovered at the time that you were not there. So I did a report to him and handed over. One of the interesting things that, as I was sitting with him in there, he said to me, he said, yeah, I understand you from people that you want my job. And I said, no ways, this job for 2 months, I have had it. I actually don't even know how I survived the 2 months. And I said, not at all. I mean, whoever said that to you, really, I'm sure they just want you to like them at my expense. But be rest assured, I don't want your job. In fact, I don't want it. And it's because you got politics, you got all sorts of nonsense happening, and you are supposed to work and do things properly. I said, no, thank you. So, and I look, at the time, Mr. Montana was very paranoid, you know, about things. He would listen to people lying, and so he operated on that
basis. From the outsider's point of view, and you don't have to be a legal expert to deliver this opinion, but who wants these jobs? It's a godforsaken, horrible place to work. There's scrutiny, and there are lies, and there are rumors, and there's political interference.
Yeah.
And God alone knows who would want to occupy these offices. They're trying to find someone who can hit up Eskom now. I mean, that I wouldn't touch with a 10-foot pole with a health inspector on the end, even if I had the qualifications to do it.
So, you know, and also at the time when Popo Molefe's board was there, there was a lot of tension between Lucky and Popo Molefe, because they then instituted this forensic investigation that was done by Worksmiths. It was in the papers everywhere, you know, and the amount of money that we paid Worksmiths and so on. So being the head of legal, I was accused of having appointed Worksmiths. And when Worksmiths was appointed, I had been fired initially by Lucky and then brought back and then to be suspended. So because I challenged him because he had fired the guy that reported to me just summarily. And I thought, this is not done. I mean, I'm the person that reports to you. If you've got issues, talk to me. This guy reports to me. This is governance, you know, simple governance. And he took issue with me. And the following day when I met him, 5 minutes in his office, and he said, out, you're fired.
So these are the kinds of dramatic stories we don't hear, because we see the reports and we see where money might have gone or who's the bad guy and good guy in the most simplistic terms possible.
Yeah.
We don't hear this stuff. I mean, the fact that you're sitting in his office and he looks you in the eye and he goes, out. No respect given. No politeness about it. Immediately he can perceive that you are now a threat and a problem.
Yeah.
And you're not, did he even attempt to bring you in?
No.
To some kind of arrangement?
No. Nothing.
Wow.
Out. And what had happened is because we in the legal department had touched a particular agreement that involved Raymond Lee. And I'm saying these to you because this is all in the public domain anyway. We've given evidence on these things.
But also the more people you tell, the more protected you will be.
That's it. Yeah. And we knew, we were told we could not touch that particular transaction. So when finally looked at this thing, we spoke about it and we said, there's no compliance here. We can't get involved. And so he thought we were working against him and he was going to deal with those that are working against. That was his language. And so when he fired Fanny, we knew that it was in relation to that because Fanny's not working with him, is working against him. So when I challenged, and you can't challenge Lucky Montana, by the way.
No, we saw when the cameras went to go and take a look at the house he was building for himself. Do you remember?
You can't challenge him.
He like threw bricks at them or something.
Sure. And and he just basically.
Were you scared?
No.
You weren't afraid. I'm just talking like you're a woman. You walk into an office of a man who's kind of by all evidence that we've seen, not terribly stable. You weren't scared for yourself.
No, I wasn't. Because, I mean, I think if anything, he knew that I would ask questions. I think I was one of those executives who challenged him at Exco. I would be called aside by some of my colleagues to say, you shouldn't be challenging this guy. He doesn't like you challenging him. And I'd be like, but then how else do we do this thing? You know? Because the approach was you come in, you speak, he would come in and speak for 2 hours and nobody would say anything. And then that's it.
It's like a tyranny.
Yeah.
Martha, to contrast your story, the reason I also want you to tell your story is because people need to know of the experience that so many in our government departments do have. Mm. And there are competent and brilliant people who work in the government and who've done a terrific job over the last 27 years. Yeah. You know, people try again to say, well, everything's a disaster, and that's not true. But in order to understand this, how does someone like Lucky Montana end up being your superior? And how does someone like that end up doing such damage to the competent people?
Yeah.
Because this is what happens, right? People go, oh, well, the whole of Pras is a write-off. Yeah. The whole of Transnet's a write-off. These state departments that are run so badly, it must be because everyone in there is diseased and corrupt.
Yeah.
So to make people understand the difference between the likes of you and the likes of him, how does he get into that position?
Well, I mean, I suppose, you know, these are government appointed people.
They don't rise up the ranks.
Well, I suppose in his case, he worked for the Department of Transport at some point. So he had that background. Look, he's a clever guy. Let me tell you.
I'm not saying he's stupid at all.
He knows the business. He knew how to run the business, you know, and his eyes were everywhere as far as the business was concerned, you know, But he had this particular style, you know, where I'm the boss and nobody can question me.
But when did your alarm bells start ringing?
At Intersight.
Already.
Already. Because I then understood that the reason I'm being moved is that I'm too much on the straight and narrow. And I thought, okay. And then I thought, okay, it's interesting that I moved from that position of CEO to group legal, risk and compliance. This is now where I'm going to entrench my, you know, straight and narrowness, as it has been said. And I thought about it and I thought, I'm not sure what is going on, whether he understands or he just said it there. And
you have to guess his agenda.
So I knew, you know, even at Intersight, I mean, there's certain experiences which I had, and I'm not a politician. So I don't know these politicians. I mean, there's a particular instruction that transaction that I was running as the CEO of Intersight, where all of a sudden, we had this particular meeting, and these were guys from, Roy Moodley's firm.
Now, just who is Roy Moodley for people who don't know?
Politicians. I mean, I think it was said that he was the guy that was giving, the previous president, Jacob Zuma, about a million rand a month.
It's not on your, yes, yeah, I remember, and he was very involved in business in KZN and funded many ANC things. So he had tentacles that went into everything.
So when he,
and you were given not so direct, because nothing's ever direct, but fairly clear instructions not to interfere in his stuff.
Well, you know, I wasn't even given that, but I got to see it. Because when I had this particular meeting, I was quite concerned because I thought, okay, fine, this is a meeting. It's a formal meeting. And people were standing up in the meeting and they were telling me, you're not running this thing properly and we'll make sure that you don't run this particular mandate anymore. And I'm thinking, who are these people? You know? And I frankly said to them, listen, I account to the Intersight board. I don't account to you guys. So really, I'm not even listening to you guys and you're not going to tell me how to do my job. I didn't know who these guys were, right? And a colleague of mine then came in and said, listen, you and I have got to have coffee outside of this building. So we went and we had coffee outside. He says, you've got no clue who those guys are. This is who they are. And effectively, they'll go back and tell Lucky what transpired. I said, well, I couldn't be bothered. You know, Lucky must speak to me if he feels that way. But in a month or two, what they had threatened me with became a reality because then they came into the office and bulldozed the office and they took all the files.
Do you mean they ransacked the
Well,
place.
Effectively, they sent the lawyer. There was a lawyer who was Lucky's legal advisor at the time.
External.
Yes.
His own personal legal
advisor. It was legal advisor who he had brought in into PRASA to advise him separate of the legal function, right? Yeah. So she came in and she was very gung-ho, removing the files and so on. I mean, I'm the CEO of this entity and I phoned one of the directors, the independent director, and I say to him, guys, if you don't want me here, tell me. Why don't you just bring people here? And I don't know anything about it. And this is what is happening. What is happening? Because the mandate comes from the board. It doesn't.
Were they looking for something in particular? Were they just harassing you?
They wanted to take the entire portfolio of advertising out of Intersight to be run at group. Right. Okay. You make a lot of money in advertising.
Sure.
And the reason it was with us, it was because it was part of the mandate of Intersight to leverage on process property portfolio. And that's what we were doing. So they that's what they did. I mean, I spoke to, hey, Lucky, I said, but boss, I report to you and you didn't tell me that this was going to happen. So people can just come into the office and basically attack me, you knowing about it and you wouldn't tell me. So I approached him.
What did he say?
He said he didn't know about it. Yeah. And then we were.
Then who instructed his lawyer?
And then we were brought into a meeting. I still thought, look, we're going to sort this out and he's going to, you know, tell these people where to get off. So a colleague of mine then says to me, you don't know. This is going to be turned against us. And I was like, no, that will never happen because I spoke to the boss himself. You have got no clue how that meeting transpired. In fact, I was accused of fraud in that meeting, and a colleague, somebody who reported to me, was actually sent packing. I was told to suspend him and get somebody else in the position. It was bad. I mean, I stood there and I thought, okay, fine. Are you insinuating that I have done some kind of fraud? Because if you are, then suspend me and so that you can do your own investigations. No, but it didn't happen that way. So that was the type of, you know, stuff.
It's like mob style intimidation tactics.
No, sure.
Right?
So when I was there, you know, so that was the one experience. So that's why when he fired this guy who reports to me, I said to him, I said, listen, don't repeat what you did at Intersight. Don't do it. Leave these guys alone. If it is me you want, deal with me. Because I'm the person that reports to you. He didn't like that, obviously, and sent me packing as well. So we then wrote to the board of Popo Malefe and we said the reasons why we are now being dealt with in this manner is because we've highlighted these transgressions in the organization. We are giving them to you. You will decide what you do with him.
And at this point, there was already public outrage about some of the deals, like the trains.
I mean, the AG had come in and said we were irregular expenditure, you know, at 550 million, you know. So these things were already out there. And so we went to the CCMA, you know, and we then were called back because the board of Popo Malefe said, no, you don't deal with people like that. If they've done something wrong, let them account. Charge them.
So he was doing the right thing. He was doing what a chairperson of a board should do.
So charge them, but you don't just fire people summarily. So he was then compelled to bring us back. He brought us back.
That must have been uncomfortable.
It was very uncomfortable, but we knew this was just, you know.
Procedure.
Within 4 days, we were suspended. We were asked to give reasons why we should not be suspended. And being the lawyers that we were, we just put in a whole lot of Latin in there and all sorts of things. And we said you were functus officio and he didn't like it. And he sent us packing. So we were escorted out of the building again, now suspended. And so when the appointment, and then he started fighting with the board, you know, at the time, 2015. It was all in the public media and stuff like that. And
that was really the undoing of Prasa at that point. It started falling apart.
Yeah. So we come back, but we come back because the then acting CEO, we understand, was then told, investigate these people. And then if they haven't done something wrong, you better charge them because we also don't want to be seen to be taking
And summons. How much time had elapsed then between that suspension and this?
Which is about 4 months.
And what are you doing during that time? Because you're not the kind of person who could sit on your hands, but you're not allowed to do work.
No, we can't do anything.
And you're being paid a salary, but you could also be going to jail if they win and can prove that you did something wrong.
Yes. So immediately I come back. You know, the CEO says, look, this is the work I've done. I can't see anything wrong with what you have done. So come back to work because anyway, you're being paid for this thing. And we, colleague of mine, came back. A couple of days after I had come back, and then that's when Mr. Montana went to the Hillborough police station to have me arrested together with Popo.
No, he's already off the board.
He's off.
I mean, he's out of the CEO role.
So,
and he's what? He's now in the glare of public outrage as well. So, but he decides to lash out at you and Popo Molefe and lays charges at Hillborough police station.
Yeah. I freak out because I wasn't even aware that this was happening. In fact, my brother calls me and says, listen, your name is on the radio. It's everywhere. What the hell have you done? You can imagine I'm sitting in the office minding my own business. I don't have a radio. And he just calls me to say something is amiss here. So I then call the chairperson and I say, listen, I'm not going to the Chukis for nonsense.
No.
It is Thursday. The idea is to have me arrested Friday, spend the weekend there. I'm not doing this. Whatever happens, give me authority to appoint lawyers. He did. So I got lawyers and they managed to move wherever it was to put in the commercial crimes unit. Right. And I was given assurance that I won't be arrested. But this is the type of experience that I have had, you know, as the head of legal. And I was investigated by the Hawks.
And at least you have some understanding of law. How many people have had this happen to them?
And they don't know the
whose
law.
Stories we will never hear, who had to languish in jail, who might still be in some cases awaiting trials of things that will never end up in court. Martha, this is horrible. And as much as you're tough, and I can tell that you're brave as hell, this must have driven you to a point where you were absolutely distracted from everything you were. You must have been paranoid and nervous yourself.
I was nervous. Because
suddenly it comes to you out of nowhere. And even though you managed to avoid having to go to jail at that time, this is an intimidation tactic. This is bullying and harassment.
Yeah.
Clean cut.
I've experienced it throughout my tenure as the head of legal at PRASA, because they knew if it was not proper, it was not going to fly. And at one point they said, you know, the legal department of PRASA thinks that they're running PRASA. So I started getting threats to say, you think you're running PRASA. And I raised that, you know, with...
Just like what, calls in the middle of the night?
Yeah, calls to say, you think you're running PRASA, you better watch it, you know. So I had a sense of the type of transactions that we were dealing with and where we had said no. And in fact, internally, you know, this colleague of mine who I worked with would escort me home after work. And fortunately, we didn't live far from each other. So he would say, listen, I am driving behind you and I have to make sure that you are in your complex. So that's how we left, right? And then, you know, there's a lot, I mean, that I can tell you. It's just crazy.
I've seen those offices. I've driven past those PRASA offices in Hatfield.
Yeah.
I know exactly where they are.
Yeah.
And you had to drive out of there wondering if someone was going to jump out.
So, you know, Gareth, it's that's the life that we lived. So I lived with my colleagues protecting me and, you know, us always watching out for each other. Fast forward. I mean, I don't think there's a single board at PRASA that did not either suspend me, put me on special leave, threaten me, Alice. I've seen it all.
So, but at this point, Martha, you know, with all due deference to your attitude to this, most people would have just said, this is not worth it. I should have either stayed in the private sector and just dealt with whatever cultural issues I might have had to put up with there, because it's going to be horrible anywhere at this point, but this is less horrible. Yes. It's a question of, you know, lesser of two evils.
Yeah.
But imagine all the people who have kowtowed, bowed, perhaps not so that they themselves could benefit in any way, but just so that they didn't have to deal with death threats in the middle of the night, worrying about whether they'd get home, worrying about which people they could trust and which people they couldn't. And if someone was actually out there trying to get you.
Yeah.
Because the stakes are that high.
They're very high. And I think for me, it was, you know, the job became something that I really wanted to do. Because having understood, at some point I acted as the CEO of PRASA Rail. Now, when you're in that position, you're basically running the entire of PRASA. I mean, it was horrifying to see how our people lived, you know, and the need for us to ensure that they do have the transport that is reliable and that is cheap and that they can, you know, use. And I think this is what drove me to say, we can't all walk away, because then those that don't have a voice will never be looked after, you know, and that's the reason why one stayed, to say we can fix this thing. We can make the systems work.
This is also why I get so annoyed with people who complain about the state of the parastatals in this country, and they unfortunately brush everyone with the same brush.
Yeah, so, not sure.
You know, you whether you are trying to do the right thing, and there are plenty, we need more, obviously, good people who are prepared to go into the public service. But when they do and they end up being treated like you do, you've got to ask yourself why. Why would anyone with good intentions even bother? Because yes, the need, I think everyone in this country understands that so many people have in the past and unfortunately now would love to depend on passenger rail.
Yes.
And for a while, though the conditions were never great for black people in townships and there were rural parts of the country that were not connected as well as anything else, there was at least something.
Yes, there was at least something.
And now there are so many people who have to rely on exorbitant taxi rates, buses, even more humiliating and ugly forms of transport. You see people walking at 4 a.m. You know where they're going. They're trying to get to work for money that will barely pay for just their transport fees.
So what you talk
and
about.
So you were there. Yeah. You were in a position now where you thought.
We could make a difference.
Exactly.
And then there was an issue about the security contracts. I need to say this because the reason why our infrastructure is as messed up as it is because of the termination of the security contract. We advised for the organization not to do it because there were no contingency plans at the time. We're proven right.
Where were they sending that money instead? Because if they justified it as cost cutting, what did they do with it besides buy trains that were too big? We know that there are certain individuals who benefited directly from tenders, whether it was around the back and it only came to light much later. Mm. As I understand it, no one's in jail yet.
No, nobody's in jail.
For any of this.
No.
I don't know. Where's Lucky Montana now?
I don't know where he is. But no one is in jail as far as PRAS is concerned.
No,
And this is the frustration I think that exists, because the one other thing is that we've worked with the Hawks. You know, we've given them all the information. We said, there it is. You got it. But nothing has happened.
So when you see Andre Dorato on TV 2 weeks ago and he's busy talking to Annika Larson and he's saying, I told the Hawks. And then you see people saying, lay your charges.
But this is it.
And he has. But what are the Hawks doing?
But this is, you know, I listen to Andre's story and I say, only if people knew. Since 2015, we have been giving information to the Hawks and saying, there it is.
So what are they doing?
Nothing to date. So, you know, I just take it that people just don't have an appreciation actually of what is all involved, and they just looking at the hype. That's my view, really, because I've experienced it myself, you know.
But that's all that ordinary citizens have to go on is the media reporting
that's
on this stuff.
Yeah.
They don't know what you know. Yeah. And thank God you're able to tell your story. Unfortunately for you, you have to do it through the courts at great personal expense.
Look, and for me, people ask me, how do you do it? I don't know how I do it, but I just do it, you know, because I believe there's certain values that I ascribe to. And I'm not a pushover.
No, that's clear. But Martha, where does it come from? I mean, you talk about values. A lot of people don't have – a lot of good people don't necessarily have good values.
Yeah.
In other words, if something comes along and they can see a chance to improve their life, they'll take it.
Sure.
How do you figure it out? Because this is a path that only you can walk. You know, every individual has to choose.
Look, I did say that I don't come from a wealthy family. My folks sacrificed a lot to educate us, right? My dad was quite tough as an individual, and he was very strict as well.
What did he do?
He was just a driver at Siemens.
Right.
You know, my mom was a nurse. And I think growing up, I mean, there was a period when my folks were arrested, right?
As activists?
My surname is actually Ngoyi with an
R. Right. I know Lillian Ngoyi and company. Yeah. Right.
So my dad, when they picked up my mom and dad, it was the association with Lillian Ngoyi because of the surname. It was crazy. And when my dad decided, look, I'm not a politician. I'm not involved in these things. But because of the association, then this, I don't want to live this type of life where my wife will just be abducted and put in jail and stuff like that. So I grew up in that environment. And also, you know, when in the 70s, 76 uprising, I mean, I was already at school. So I saw certain things, and I saw how my family accommodated the students. My mother would make soup for the students that were running away from the cops, you know. And so we grew up like that.
And it imbued in you a sense of right and wrong, fairness and unfairness.
Yeah. Do the right thing.
But by observation, not because your parents sat you down around the table and told you.
You know, And I guess, you know, also church, we had to go to church. My dad was an elder in church. We did church, and I was very involved in church as well, Catholic, all through and through. So I grew up with that, you know, and I have an appreciation. I hate injustice. And I've always known that I was going to be a lawyer. Even at school, I said, this is where I'm going. And I loved it, you know.
Do you think that sense of fair and unfair was also one of the reasons that you were pulled into law?
Yes. Yes.
Because you saw the law as a mechanism, like so many of us who studied law. I did, but I never finished. but so many of us who studied law, I remember because I asked people who were also in first year with me, I said, well, why are you doing this? And the answer was usually something around, you know, you don't, because law doesn't necessarily mean you make money.
Yeah.
No. There are lots of jobs in law which are not actually particularly good paying jobs.
Sure.
But I think everybody had some, it was a way of correcting and checking and balancing stuff that just seemed like it wasn't working properly.
That's right. So with that background and with the appreciation, I mean, as I say, I lived in a three-room house. Our family home was a three-room
house.
Humble. Do you understand? I mean, my mother used to wake us up at 4 a.m. to study because there was a shebeen that was playing music till 2 a.m. next door. You couldn't do anything about it. That was the township. That was the life. So, you know, with this, but the bottom line is that they sacrificed a lot for us to get a good education and for us to grow up well. And I've always had this thing. And as I say, you know, having also seen the struggles of our people and wanting to make a difference, you know, and that's why I've stayed. And when I see the corruption that is there and I'm saying, no ways, this is our money. This is, you know, you and I are paying taxes. You know, we cannot allow this to happen, you know, and I was seen as a thorn within the organization. And that's why I'm saying to you at every given point, I mean, even when the SIU investigated me at some point, this particular investigator of the SIU came to me in a meeting and said, why is it that in your case, every single board that comes in here wants your neck? And I said, I don't know. You, the investigator, you tell me. I said, because if I've done something wrong, I must account for it, you know. But other than that, I don't know. You know, until obviously I was fired. I mean, in 2021, Jeff, I was fired in 2021 on the basis that my contract was a 5-year contract. I've been permanent at PRASA. Mm. I've been there since 2011. Do you understand? For somebody to come in who doesn't know who I am, to say you have a 5-year contract, get out. Your 5 years is up, and you're not required here anymore. And then the following day, there were media articles about how I, you know, it attracts. I'm the group executive of legal risk and compliance at PRASA. I'm supposed to operate at a particular level, ethics and comply. Because what it then does, because the reality is that even though I'm not a practicing attorney, I'm a non-practicing attorney, I'm still on the roll of non-practicing attorneys. This could jeopardize my career if I'm accused of fraud.
Absolutely. And then you cannot practice law at all.
Yeah. So this was out there. Boom.
But also, Leonard Ramatlak, I mean, this whole situation, because your current fights that you're waging in the courts, and these things take a long time. That's another thing, people. They want immediate gratification, like ordering from McDonald's.
Yeah.
But the courts, the wheels of justice turn very slowly.
Yeah.
And we said earlier, no one's gone to jail, but someone will have to at some point.
Somebody will have to at some point.
And suddenly when all of this starts happening, people go, so there are competent things going on.
Yeah.
Are you concerned, though, that your case will not get the response that it requires? I mean, clearly the hawks don't care. You've now taken on your own legal representation. You know, they say only a fool has themselves for a client. Yeah. That's another thing they taught us in first year. So you knew to bring.
I know. Yeah.
So, Jeffrey, where are we at the moment in terms of Martha's status, her case? How are we looking in terms of she's already won a number of very, very important victories here, which is why she's now able to talk about these things. Mm. And I'm just sorry that so few people in the media have taken an interest because really it hasn't. I have not heard this story. And if you weren't sitting in front of me, Martha, I wouldn't ever have.
Right.
Thank God you are. But where are we now?
Yeah, I mean, it's a long story. You know, I mean, even just it took me close to 8 months sitting with Martha. I actually spend more time with Martha than I do with my own family sometimes. but where are we at now? So, you know, as you said, there was an arbitration. Martha was charged with, I think it was 5 charges, some of which directly referred to her evidence at the Zondo Commission.
So this post-Zondo Commission.
Post-Zondo Commission. So she was
So, is that even admissible in an arbitration?
Well,
if you're called by the Deputy Chief Justice to testify in front of the commission, surely some arbitration panel doesn't have any locus standi, is what you guys call it, right? Am I right?
Yeah.
Well, you know, I mean, we prepared for those charges, and I mean, the response to that quite simply was that you charging her because she exposed corruption. And here it is. Here's the transcript. It's on your own charge sheet.
Embarrassing for them.
And then, there was a long fight about it, various postponements again and again and again. And that's one of the patents, unfortunately, I think for one of the reasons, among others, that entities like Price are in the state that they are, is legal fees. I mean, you know, for these lawyers, they can postpone and postpone and postpone, but then for an individual, eventually, they're going to say,
The state's footing their bill, they're not paying yours.
Exactly. But anyway, it's just to catch the chest.
I hope you're not charging like a wounded buffalo. otherwise, we'll have conversations after this.
No, he's not. Thank God.
Definitely.
So you're also partly doing this out of a sense of civil responsibility, civic responsibility.
Yes, definitely. And I mean, all the advocates and counsel that we've got have all, everyone that's come in, we've all done it on that kind of extremely reduced.
But you're also confident that you have the upper hand here and that you're fighting the good fight.
No, of course.
So in the end, this will be the kind of bill that the people of South Africa would be happy to pay if they find against them and with costs in your favor.
But I mean, just to quickly answer the question about where we are at in the legal with the cases that we're at now. So I was actually thinking about it in my head while you were chatting, just trying to think how many there are. And I think there are four between Martha and Prasa. So the there's a summons against her in the High Court for the 54 million rand related to the fence and gate issue. It was also something that she was charged with at the arbitration, and she was cleared of that. Price has taken the arbitration award and review to the Labor Court. That's number two. And then there's a Labor Appeal Court case on Tuesday, which deals with them having fired Martha because she was supposedly on a 5-year contract. And then I think there's also...
And that one's fairly easy to sort out because that's just... Here's the contract.
No, exactly. Yeah, no. I mean, and that's exactly what you've been saying the whole time. But I mean, again, you know, I mean, for Price's lawyers, it's not a problem, and for the people that instruct them, it's also not a problem.
And there's no urgency on their part.
No. I mean, the only reason that Martha actually managed that we got to where we were was that after Martha was fired on this 5-year contract, she went to court on an urgent basis. To say that if I'm on a 5-year contract, give me the contract. Give it to me. And then Prasa just couldn't reply to it in the papers. I mean, to this day, they've never been able to reply to it. And they raised various technical points about to say the case is not urgent.
So what are your best and worst case scenario? Because you guys go into this with certain things you want to achieve.
Right.
What would you like besides turning this poor woman's life back into a life and granting her at least the absolution of these seemingly utterly ridiculous claims that she isn't somehow in the wrong, even though she's the one who was making everyone aware of what was actually going on there. Aside from that, what are you after?
Well, I think a number of things. I mean, firstly, I mean, the one thing about Martha's case and Prasa is that it's not middle class people who are affected by the destruction of the trains.
No.
I mean, as you said earlier, it's poor people.
They're not using them.
Yeah. I mean, it's been going on for years. It's only
there's not Rovos Rail.
Yeah, exactly.
and the blue train.
So I think it's important for people who are in these entities that do want to genuinely be there and run a good organization, where there's this culture of fear and you can't speak out, and I want to speak out, but I'm too scared because there's this organization, this beast that has limitless pockets, to show that you can win against these people. Sure. They're not invincible.
And one small victory will empower other people.
That's it.
Exactly.
But the thing that worries me, Martha, is that being a whistleblower, there's no reward here. Personally, like, you're not going to suddenly, if you win all these cases, be given some lump sum and be allowed to retire in the French Riviera. No. I mean, you've already paid a very heavy price for this, and you will continue to pay a price for this, because there's no chance in hell that the government will ever hire you in any capacity again. Yeah. Right. So you've cut that out. That's never impossible. I've got more of a chance as someone who sits and criticizes them every day than you do.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. But also,
the other thing is that the private sector are nervous.
Yeah.
They do lots of business with government. Yeah. So if someone hires you, what kind of career prospect does this create for you?
Look, and this is the challenge that one has, you know, because I can't do anything. When I was suspended, like now fighting these cases, and I'd apply for a job, you know, I'd go through certain levels.
And then
they'd
meet you and they'd go,
and then, they would say, you know, the process issue is still outstanding. So unfortunately, and I found myself, and then I decided I'm not doing this anymore because it's working on my psyche as well. You know, I was just too stressed and too sick and it was just not right.
Let alone that we don't have any witness protection programs in South Africa. We don't have protections for whistleblowers. We've heard horrific stories in the past 5 to 10 years of people who have done what Martha's done, who've just disappeared.
Yeah. So like now when we won the case, I mean, and I was cleared of all the charges, right?
Yeah, let's be clear about that. Yeah. That's a big deal.
Cleared. It was a big deal. I mean, when Jeff phoned me that morning, I was like, my God.
Did you cry?
I didn't cry, but I was like, God, I thank God so many times. I don't know what I said
there
to
were
you,
a few,
Jeff.
There were a few hallelujahs.
That's it. Yeah. Hallelujah. I mean, I couldn't, you know. But also, and I thought, gosh, now I'm going to live my life, you know. And then I actually started talking to Pumi and I said, I need to work on my profile now going forward. Man, I'm here now. I mean, Jeff and I said, we went to the office the following day, you know, and Jeff came with me to say, go report for duty, because obviously if you stay away, the chances are they're going to say you're AWOL. And so you can't do that because you're not suspended anymore. You've been cleared of the charges. We go, and then there at reception, we get told, no, they don't want you. They're still studying the review. Go home. So we leave. And now this application, they've
brought. But you must have taken such a deep breath when you walked in there, because you're walking into the most hostile environment. But it's like in an army going into your enemy's camp and parading around there.
Yeah. But what was interesting was the reception I received from the employees. They were like, come back.
Oh, wow.
We need you to come back. Thank God. I mean,
because since you've gone, it's just become worse. There's now no oversight whatsoever.
So, I mean, I had to say to guys, listen, you got to behave. You're
putting yourself in the firing line.
Yeah, this is a reception that don't make so much noise. But the noise that people were like, we don't care that we associated with you. Yay. And the people were very happy that I had won and that I was coming back. But yeah, now we settled with this application they bring. And for me, you know, Gareth, it's all about what the hell now? Because the legal fees that one has, I mean, with 3 years, one has been paying legal fees. In fact, maybe it's important to say that Jeff comes in when our previous attorneys, basically, I can say, dumped us because it was the issue of fees. We couldn't afford to pay, you know, the amounts they required and, you know, there were challenges.
I'm glad you're here. We can give you some credit.
Thank you.
So we stuff. Really, we were stuck because once you receive a notice of termination as an attorney of record, I mean, I know what that means. It's like, we don't have legal representation. We're fighting this beast. Who is going to take our case? Thank God Jeff was available. And Jeff, and it's true. I mean, the amount of money, I mean, I owed over 1.1 million rands, you know, and I hadn't gotten anywhere.
Yeah.
With my case. And when Jeff came in, I mean, we've done the disciplinary hearing and they've really reduced their fees. Even counsel has reduced their fees in light of this particular matter being, you know, some kind of a public interest matter, you know. And we've told our truth. They've seen it. And because we work with evidence as well, They've seen the evidence that we've given them because we've just not said things. But this is where we are. I mean, I'm sitting again. And one of the things that we talk to is that in one of the meetings that I once attended after having given an opinion with a colleague on the appointment of the administrator, you have got absolutely no clue what transpired. A meeting was called 6 o'clock in the morning. Nobody must be giving an excuse. In that meeting, the DG of transport, you know, basically said those people who have become rogue, it's because I had given that opinion. I had basically challenged the decision of the minister. It was unheard of.
Who was Minister of Transport at that point?
This was Figile still.
Figile Mbalula.
Yeah. And his DG at the time came into that room and said, these people must actually be fired. And I must go and fight PRASA outside. And they'll never be able to sustain the might of PRASA financially.
So basically, we'll destroy you.
Yeah. So this is what I'm going
to do. Open threat.
Yeah. Mm. And I said that in my court papers. I said, this is what the DG said, called us rogue, and said, this is what must happen to us.
I hope those people realize that one day they'll be at the receiving end of government money against them.
Yeah. So this is what I'm going through now. Yeah.
I mean, if there's any justice in this world, and I genuinely hope there is for you, but for all of us, so where do you go after this? Let's say everything goes your way here. What would you really like to end up doing? Because I would hate to lose someone like you to another country, which you've probably considered.
I thought about it, yeah.
Where would you ideally like to go, Martha, and what would you like to do?
I've thought about leaving the country. I really have. I mean, I've got a daughter who has gone through this crap as well with me.
For her, because she doesn't deserve this.
Yeah, she doesn't deserve it. You know, and I love my country. This is my country, and we have to get it right, you know. We're at the end of the day, so two minds about it. Let me say this to you now, right, and I thought about it. If I were to, and I will be successful, and I'm supposed to go to work, rest assured I will go.
You'll be there.
Yeah. Because what I'm realizing is that I actually don't have a fear of going back and then taking my desk and working. I've done absolutely nothing wrong. And I, the people that are obviously doing this to me clearly have a concern.
But they've also, they seem to be running out of ammo.
Yeah.
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 You can only make stuff up and lie about someone so much.
I think the arbitration award was a big shock to PRASA.
Yeah.
I don't think that they expected that they would lose it at all. And I don't think that they expected that they would lose it so badly. And I think that that really
rattled them.
It's put things on the back pedal big time.
If you reoccupy your desk and there are these people who've been actively working to torment you in their positions, that's just going to render the place even more useless because they will be stopping you at every turn.
Well, they think they will. But this is the thing. This is a problem. That's why they don't want me there, because they know they can't stop me. And the employees know that they had – the legal department was quite strong, very strong. And our employees relied on the advice that we gave them. In fact, we became some kind of a psychologist. My office was kind of a psychologist office because people would come there after hours and say, God, what do I do here? You know, so having that strength within the organization assisted a lot of employees because they felt comforted as well to say, we know once you guys have come in and have said X, you will really protect us and we are doing this thing right. So I can go back in there today and occupy my office and work. I don't think they can work with me in light of what has transpired. It's their issue. They must deal with it, right? We need to fix that organization. It is an important organization, as I said, for our people. And it's got to work, you know? And the reality is if we all leave, you know, then what? You know, some of us have got to stay behind. I could have resigned. I could have resigned in the midst of all this. I could have resigned, but it was very clear that that's not an option that I'm going to take. But also it was important for me to clear my name because they messed it up. You know, when this thing came out in the media the first time on that Saturday of the 30th of January, I phoned the the one of the news ladies, ENCA, who had gone out on Twitter, and I said to her, do you know who you're speaking to? No, she doesn't know. I said, do you know how easy it was for me to get your numbers? I said, this is Martha Ngoyi. This is the person you've just gone out on a statement that is riddled with lies. I'm a professional. You didn't bother to get my side of the story. You just went out.
Yeah, and you know what? The media should actually be covered in the same opprobrium that we have for the corrupt politicians, because they are not doing anybody fair service here. They're not even prepared to read anything more than a paragraph before they draw up some clickbait headline. In many of these, I'm not addressing this particular situation, but in many of these stories. Yeah. Listen, I know that some of this has probably been laborious for you to have to go over again. I think that for those people who are listening to it, this is tremendously eye-opening, because most of us will never hear the detail of one person's experience in all of this.
Let me just say one thing. I am now asked to go to give evidence. Obviously, I can't speak about it. I'm still on the stand in a Judicial Services Commission matter of a judge who is about to be impeached. And I'm required to go and give evidence in that matter as well. So do you understand? I'm here, I'm there, and I'm still doing it. But I am going to do it, because it has to be done.
How old are you?
We can't tolerate things like this to happen. So I haven't had any rest effectively, but it must be done, you know. And this is where we are. And we just filed, in fact, my answering affidavit today in relation to the stay application, and we'll see where it goes. But the bottom line is that I think at the end of the day, people who are abusing state resources have got to pay the money back.
Well, we almost need worse punishments than just that.
Yeah, I suppose. Yeah,
because it's such a betrayal of the public trust.
Yeah, because we're struggling really to raise funds to pay our lawyers. I mean, as Jeffrey says, he spends a lot of time with me than with his family, because, you know, when anything comes up, Jeff, and he's been there, you know, and has really fought this fight with us.
Thank you so much for coming to tell your story here. I hope that it goes far and wide, and that many, many South Africans get to hear it.
Sure.
Again, thank you for your bravery. I'm sure that there is much more to be revealed, and you say let the chips fall where they may.
Sure.
And let's see what the evidence is
that
these people have against you, supposedly. And let's see what you have to defend yourself with. Yeah. But I'm very pleased that you are out there doing this and fighting this fight. I'm sure it's soul-destroying sometimes.
It is, yeah.
Just know that there are a couple of us, just like there are only a few whistleblowers, there are a couple of us who really are backing you. And Jeff, thank you for your steadfast support of Martha, because she couldn't do it without you.
No, I couldn't.
And we couldn't do this without you. So
thank you.
Yeah. Keep fighting the good fight, guys. Thank you.
Thank you so much, and thanks for this opportunity. CliffCentral.com.